Welcome to Holistic Health Hour. I am your host, Dr. Nusheen Darvish. Practicing regenerative, functional, naturopathic medicine for the past 30 years has certainly transformed my health and the health of my patients. For the next 30 to 60 minutes, I, along with some of our invited guests and colleagues, will share some clinical pearls integrating the science of Western medicine with the wisdom of Eastern medicine to assist you in creating your health and well-being. Check out other Holistic Health Hour podcasts by subscribing or visiting us on drdarvish.com. That's drdarvish.com. Please note this podcast and any information shared within it are for informational purposes only and are not intended to make any claims or provide any diagnosis or treatment for any particular condition, symptoms, or disease. Please seek the advice and evaluation of your own personal healthcare provider. Welcome to Holistic Health Hour, and I'm here, your host, Dr. Nusheen Darvish. Today, we are delving into the second part of a four-part series on chronic Lyme disease, or what some call chronic multiple infection syndrome, or tick-borne infections. And we're looking at these group of infections as the great imitator, and we'll get into that in just a few minutes. These infections mimic a myriad of chronic symptoms and diseases, and therefore we call it the great imitator. However, there is a lot of misdiagnoses out there. A lot of patients are misdiagnosed with all sorts of chronic diseases instead of some of these infections, and therefore there is treatments that are not appropriately prescribed, and the patient's complaints are ignored often by specialists, and patients end up moving from one medical specialist to another in order to find solutions because they do not fit into the Western medicine typical diagnostic box of conditions and diseases. So their symptoms and conditions can transgress the normal Western diagnosis and treatments. And sadly, the result of their misdiagnosis and mistreatment can often have grave results. Unless they're lucky enough to come across a more integrative physician who looks at the whole picture, who specializes in tick-borne infections, in chronic infections, in complex illnesses, and who provides a complex and comprehensive treatment to address all the nuances that are important in addressing the whole body in these kind of conditions. One of these doctors is with me today. This is Dr. Marion. She's one of my colleagues from Holistic, and she is very, very passionate about finding the root cause of chronic illness, chronic disease, integrating the mind, the body, and the spirit, and really combining the science of Western medicine with the wisdom of Eastern medicine to transform the health and well-being of these chronically ill patients. Welcome, Dr. Marion. Thank you so much for joining me on another episode of Holistic Health Hour.
Thanks for having me.
So last week, we covered a part of one of the series with you on Lyme disease and tick-borne infections, complex illnesses. This week, we are delving a little bit more deeper, this time on symptoms and the disease that these infections mimic, and how can we prevent or reduce our risks for getting a tick bite. And what do we do when we do get a tick bite? And this is something we discussed earlier in our little pre-conversation here as to most of us have not been taught as to how to remove a tick bite. And yet many of us are out there on the beaches of California. We know now can carry ticks in the woods, in the grasses, in the mountains. Most of us here in North America, at least in the Northwest, are outside, outdoors, enjoying the beautiful nature. And yet, if we get a tick, we don't know what to do with it. So we're going to spend a little bit of time at the very end to discuss how to remove a tick. So thank you again for joining me, Dr. Marion. Let's get right into it. As both of us know, many of our patients experience these chronic infections with a host of symptoms and syndromes. And again, a lot of these are misdiagnosed and mistreated. So can you tell me, why is this diagnosis so difficult to make?
Yeah, absolutely. So it really is a complicated issue, and a lot of factors go into both the identification of potential people that should be tested, as well as complicating factors as far as testing goes. And then a really important component of it, I would say, is the lack of awareness within the medical system. And so a lot of those, a lot of the providers that have not been trained specifically in Lyme disease or Lyme-related illnesses don't know either the presenting symptoms or the appropriate approach towards diagnosis. And so a lot of patients will not get the answers that they seek when they're approaching a provider. But Lyme really is a multi-system infection, primarily involving the skin, joints, nervous system, including the brain, as well as the heart and the bladder. But at this point, and I don't know if you could probably agree with me, Dr. Darvish, is that we really have seen Lyme present as almost anything. And at this point, we're doing a lot more screening than I was ever previously, because Lyme can present so uniquely and so different in different patients. One of the speakers at the last ILADS conference that I went to sort of described, basically, if a patient is diagnosed with something like rheumatoid arthritis or lupus or some other chronic illness, but doesn't quite fit that picture. For example, there's something called seronegative rheumatoid arthritis, which means they have the symptoms, but not the labs to correspond. But a lot of Lyme patients will basically fit the syndrome of a Western diagnosis, but something will be not quite right. Something will be not quite fitting about it. And so that's kind of one of the flags that I have in my mind when a patient is saying, I was diagnosed with this, but they're not really sure and it's different in this way. Then I'm like, that might be something else entirely. Lyme is also a slow progressing disease. And so when something is kind of smoldering along and just gradually worsening over time, it can be really difficult to recognize, right? Like patients may start to have knee pain, but maybe they went for a run and then suddenly they're having headaches, but maybe they were feeling dehydrated. And so slowly over time, it becomes more significant, but because of that slow speed to the progression, it's difficult for both patients and providers to identify. And then treatment is complicated as well. And so the progression of the illness is difficult to assess, because patients might be getting better for a little while. Maybe they were treated with antibiotics or herbs or whatever it is. And then, you know, they sort of assume like, oh, I'm cured. And then suddenly, maybe months or years later, symptoms start to flare again. And so once those symptoms flare again, it's sometimes difficult to assess whether that's Lyme again or that's something else. And so again, just complicating the diagnosis as well as the prognosis of the illness. And so as you were mentioning, Lyme is considered a great imitator. The first great imitator, or the disease that really coined that term initially, was syphilis. And so syphilis was called the great imitator because it can present very similar to a large variety of other diseases, which of course complicates the diagnosis, especially in later stages. So Lyme is technically the second great imitator. However, of course, at this point in time, because it is so common and so pervasive in the world, really, I would consider it as having superseded syphilis and become the great imitator.
I agree. And I just wanted to highlight the fact that the diagnosis of these tick-borne infections is really more of a clinical diagnosis mm-hmm. versus a laboratory-driven diagnosis, which basically means that you have to go see a doctor who is experienced in tick-borne infections in complex diseases in order to get an appropriate diagnosis and then an appropriate treatment. And what we mean by that is that, for instance, you may have been diagnosed with the syndrome of symptoms that we call rheumatoid arthritis. And you may be on steroid drugs and anti-inflammatory medications and immune suppressive medications, all of which will actually drive the infection of tick-borne infections, Lyme infections, even deeper. And so patients often get sicker and sicker and sicker because these immunosuppressive medications, these anti-inflammatories, these steroid drugs are weakening the immune response and allowing for an open field for the bacteria, the spirochetes, to burrow even deeper into the cells, into the nervous system, and cause further neurological disease and symptomology, not necessarily immediately, but maybe years later. And so it becomes very, very complex to identify these patients' real diagnoses and instigate a proper treatment. So the other aspect of this that I just wanted to review from last episode is the transmission of these infections can be from ticks, spiders, stinging insects, your pets, dogs, horses, mammals, basically, but also from human to human. There is some evidence that there may be a vertical transmission, in other words, from mother to child and from partner to partner. So we have to often look at the whole family and look to see what's going on with the family symptoms, the children, the mother, the father, when there is one person within the family that's coming to us ill. Okay, Doc, let's get a little bit deeper about this great imitator. Should we cover some symptoms?
Yeah, absolutely. So one thing I want to mention is that one little bug bite can lead to really a lifetime of debilitating symptoms. And or, of course, the transmission can come from other routes aside from a bug bite. But as far as when you know, considering prevention, we really want to be able to recognize early symptoms so that treatment can begin as soon as possible. Because whether or not we see or there is a known or visible tick bite, it's really imperative to be able to identify those. Acute Lyme disease is treated relatively easy at onset, but becomes much more complicated if it's left untreated and it develops into chronic Lyme disease. So that's why we want to do these podcasts as far as educating people and the public and being able to identify not only the signs of a tick bite and the fact that the tick might be present, but really the symptoms that can develop afterwards in case you don't see the tick. And it's some people assume the ticks are kind of big, and I don't know if you can just go ahead and Google it. They're very, very small, barely fit on the tip of your finger. And so often they do go missed. They just look like a speck of dirt or sand. And then as far as Lyme disease itself, it really is divided into three stages. So there's early localized disease, which is usually about 7 to 14 days after the bite. Some providers or scientists put that range at about 3 to 30 days. So it's not super clear cut. Then there's early disseminated, which is more like weeks to months after the bite. And then there's late Lyme disease symptoms, which is usually months to years after the bite. So let's just get into some of the signs and symptoms of early acute Lyme disease. Again, usually between 3 to 30 and or somewhere around 7 to 14 days. So within the first month. And those can include fever, chills, a pounding, throbbing headache, persistent, noticeable fatigue. You can have numbness and tingling, muscle and joint aches. You have swollen lymph nodes. Often we see facial or Bell's palsy, which is the loss of muscle tone or the drooping on one or both sides of the face. And then, of course, we get to the erythema migrans rash or the bullseye rash, which is sort of funny that this is kind of the famous Lyme disease symptom, because Dr. Darvish and I were discussing right before the recording of this The actual percentage of people that get infected that develop an erythema migrans or a bullseye rash is highly debated. The CDC vastly overestimates it at about 50 to 70%, but a lot of Lyme experts put that number between 5 and 10% or so. But it's a bit debated in the community, of course, because if diagnosis is complicated and there's so much underdiagnosis, as well as people only recognizing, you know, 20 years later, maybe that they were exposed 20 years prior, obviously making that statistic really complicated to identify. The rash may appear 3 to 30 days after a bite, and sometimes before the fever. And then there are, of course, Lyme-related illnesses, which are sometimes co-infections or sometimes their own infections. And those include, a couple of them are Rocky Mountain spotted fever and tularemia. And the rash of Rocky Mountain spotted fever varies from person to person, but it can be flat, non-itchy spots, flat pink spots starting on the ankles, feet, hands, wrists, and spreading up to the trunk. And that usually starts 3 to 5 days after a bite. And sometimes we see petechiae or little purple spots in about 30 to 60% after the sixth day. And then as far as tularemia goes, it causes an ulcer at the site of the rash, followed by lymph node swelling in the region. And then early disseminated Lyme can look quite similar, I would say, to the list of symptoms that I just mentioned. Muscle aches, chronic fatigue, migrating joint pain, arthritis, foot pain, brain fog, unusual rashes, and then again, that bullseye can show up. And I would say one thing to sort of identify here is the migrating element of the joint pain, or sometimes people call this wandering pain. It's not quite pathognomonic, which means in medicine, one-to-one relationship, because of course other conditions can have this sort of wandering element to pain, but that's usually a flag for me as a provider when someone says, well, 1 second my knee hurts, and then literally 3 seconds later my hip hurts, or my quadricep hurts, and then my bicep hurts, or whatever. It's just kind of like bouncing out around all over the body, and that's a really big flag that there is some sort of chronic infection, but particularly Borrelia burgdorferi, which is Lyme, and or Bartonella, which is a co-infection of Lyme. So that migrating or wandering pain is a huge flag. And then as far as the chronic Lyme disease, it can look similar as far as the early acute Lyme disease. And this usually occurs weeks, months, or even years after the bite. And that can involve really severe headaches and neck stiffness. I have one patient right now whose really primary symptom is almost entirely neck stiffness with this migraine pattern that shows up right before her menstrual cycle. So she's been diagnosed for years with just menstrual migraines and neck stiffness from having bad ergonomics at her workstation. Of course, like 5 or 10 years after that's really not improving with hormone treatments or ergonomics correcting. She was eventually diagnosed by myself with Lyme. We can also see persistent fatigue and exhaustion. Additionally, we can see erythema migrans or bullseye rashes showing up sort of later on and in different places from the bite on the body. There's often arthritis and severe joint pain and swelling, especially in the knees and other large joints. And that's usually more of a symptom that is specific to the more chronic stages of Lyme. And just as an aside, I'm going to get back to that list, but I want to remind listeners from the previous podcast that Lyme has a spirochete shape. So it has a little corkscrew shape. And this is similar to syphilis. And so it's not surprising that both of these are the great imitators. So as we're going through these lists of symptoms, you might be like, how is this infection causing so many different symptoms in so many different parts of the body? And one of the reasons is because the spirochete can literally corkscrew into tissues. And so it swirls down into muscles, into joints, into the nervous system, past the blood-brain barrier. And that's really how it's getting to these different compartments in the body. So we can also see pain in tendons, muscles, joints, and bones even, again, intermittently and often wandering. So it's bouncing from location to location. We can see irregular heartbeat. This is known as Lyme carditis, so inflammation of the heart. People can experience this as heart palpitations, which are quite common for women, especially if they're anemic or around their menstrual cycle, but it can actually also be a sign of Lyme disease. There can be dizziness or shortness of breath. There's often inflammation of the brain and spinal cord. There's often nerve pain. There's also shooting pains, numbness, tingling, or burning sensation in the hands or the feet. You might have been diagnosed with neuropathy. There's often problems with short-term memory, as well as balance and difficulty walking and other neurological problems. And then there's frequently mental health issues, including depression and anxiety. And this is where, you know, it's quite a sensitive topic, because sometimes patients will go in with this laundry list of symptoms to their providers, and the provider runs a whole host of labs, and they say, well, you're normal. All these labs are within normal limits. I'm going to diagnose you with depression, essentially implying that it's all in the patient's head. Or what the patient often takes home is that this is really all in my head. I'm totally healthy, and I'm somehow making this up because of my mental health problem. And that is incredibly tragic, I would say, because the patient not only doesn't get the diagnosis that they need or the treatment that they need, but then they suddenly start to develop a complex as to, well, maybe I created this. And maybe through the stress and my emotional trauma and this and that, I somehow created this physical illness in my body. And that's so tragic to me when patients start to take on that burden of, the causal factor of this illness, which is an exogenous and external force. It's an infection. So it's definitely not all in your head.
Absolutely. And it does drive that depression, that anxiety even deeper. And they end up on a lot of different antidepressants if they were treated for the infections and acknowledged that they've got a physiological issue going on, that they could potentially overcome the chronic depressive episodes that they are facing, the OCDs that they are experiencing, the intense anxiety that is debilitating for them. So I agree with you that this is really a big, big issue for the medical system to get educated on chronic infectious syndromes, on these tick-borne infections, and learn how to diagnose them from a clinical perspective versus from just the laboratory testing, because majority of laboratory tests don't come out positive, especially when these infections have burrowed into the nervous system and the antibody reaction is no longer available in the blood system. And so those antibody tests that we do are not showing these infections as being present, and we deny the infection. We say, nope, there's no Lyme, go on next door. So one other symptom, one other condition that oftentimes patients at near end stage develop and are completely maybe oblivious to their initial symptoms is brain tumors. Mm-hmm. And majority of brain tumors, I've seen glioblastomas, meningiomas, a lot of the different types of brain tumors, astrocytomas, can be a result of these tick-borne infections that have kind of quietly gone unknown for several years, maybe even decades, and then they show up in the brain as a tumor. And then at that point, basically all hell breaks loose, and the doctors, the patient, the family members are dumbfounded as to what to do with such a patient. And we've worked quite a bit with a number of these patients, with relatively good success in terms of increasing quality of their life and increasing the length of their life and reducing side effects from their conventional therapies. So mm-hmm. I wanted to bring that up to awareness. The other aspect of this that I want to bring to awareness.
And lymphomas, just to add.
Lymphomas, yes.
Lymphomas and then breast cancers. We're starting to really look at Bartonella, which is a co-infection of Lyme or cat scratch disease.
Yes. I'm glad you brought up the lymphoma thing because there was a study that was done a few years ago and they looked at six patients. They re-evaluated the biopsy of six patients' tumors and they found that five out of six actually had Borrelia. They had Lyme disease instead of lymphoma. And we've seen many of those patients, treated them for these infections with quite a bit of success. One of the other common things that is often kind of thrown to the side, especially on the West Coast, is when people are having neurological symptoms and they go in for a radiology imaging, MRI, and the radiologist reports white matter foci and says this is probably some kind of a small vascular disease, vasculitis, and basically it's pushed to the side and never looked at again by any of the doctors on the West Coast. And yet these white matter foci are often a sign that there is an infection going on in the brain as a result of these tick-borne infections. So I wanted to just bring that up, that neurological diseases, including brain tumors and any kind of lesions that may be found in the brain, including MS lesions, can actually be a sign of these tick-borne infections that have borrowed very, 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 very deep. Mm-hmm. So I think we drove that message home, didn't we, Doc? So can you share with us some of the diagnoses that often are triggered or perhaps mimic chronic Lyme disease or these tick-borne infections? What kind of diagnoses are we talking about that really the individual who has been diagnosed with these diagnoses should delve deeper, should perhaps see a chronic complex disease specialist to further be evaluated for some of these tick-borne infections?
Yeah, so some of the diagnoses that I'm about to go over, like Dr. Darvish was mentioning, can both mimic and trigger, can mimic Lyme and or be triggered by chronic Lyme. So for example, with multiple sclerosis, as naturopathic doctors, we are not denying the existence of this disease. There is very much particular signs on imaging and blood work that can indicate the presence of something like multiple sclerosis or rheumatoid arthritis or lupus. But as naturopathic doctors, we are looking for the root cause of these conditions. And so that's when we get into the discussion of the fact that Borrelia burgdorferi and its little friends that often are transmitted in the same tick bite or in utero transmission can lead to some of the immunological dysregulation, neurological dysregulation, hormone dysregulation, and so forth, that then develops into some of these other conditions that conventional medicine, that medicine in general has dubbed certain terms. So those include quite a variety, but some of the really common ones that are mimicked or triggered by Lyme are multiple sclerosis, as I mentioned, amyotrophic lateral sclerosis or ALS, Parkinson's disease, rheumatoid arthritis, systemic lupus erythematosus, reflex sympathetic dystrophy, polymyalgia rheumatica, chronic fatigue and immune dysfunction syndrome, chemical sensitivity or multiple chemical sensitivity disorder. Bipolar disorder is often something that we see as a presentation of Lyme, as well as schizophrenia, ADHD, ADD, especially in children, autism, really any mental health presentation. We can see fungal hypersensitivities, so sensitivity to yeast and molds, and really just every autoimmune disease. Put it on this list, including Hashimoto's and Graves, which are both autoimmune conditions of the thyroid. We see just subclinical hypothyroidism. So it's not always an autoimmune condition that is driving the thyroid to dysfunction. It's sometimes just not functioning well, and the underlying causes Pirelli pictorferi. Sometimes we'll see adrenal insufficiency, hyperparathyroidism, Addison's disease, and then menopause and other hormone transitions can actually be sort of mistaken for Lyme because there's hot flashes and mood changes and fatigue and weight gain. And certainly some of those things can occur with sort of the natural hormone transition, but sometimes what's being missed is Lyme and Lyme-related illnesses.
And I think it's also important to note that any symptom, especially if it feels unusual and strange, symptoms can be a sign of these tick-borne infections or chronic complex infections. So it is important if you are experiencing any unusual symptoms or group of symptoms, then seek a provider who can help with a more comprehensive evaluation and diagnosis. And by that, I also mean, if you have symptoms in every system or different systems in your body, for instance, you have rash on your skin, or you have neurological symptoms, numbness or tingling, or you have heart palpitations, digestive system issues, emotional issues. So if you've got symptoms in different system areas of the body, then it is possible that there could be a chronic infection going on, because these infections have the capacity to travel in blood and go from tissue to tissue and harbor in those areas. So look for multiple symptoms, and then make sure you see a provider that can address that. One other one that I wanted to really point out is children born to mothers who have tick-borne infections that have been underdiagnosed, not treated, often can have behavioral issues. They can have sensory nervous system issues. In other words, they can be hypervigilant. They can be sensitive to tags of under clothing, colors of the jeans. They can have behavioral issues, ADHD, ADD, have sleep issues, digestive problems, I mean, and be part of the spectrum of autistic spectrum disorders, and be very, very sensitive to foods, to environment, to any kind of stress. And these are the children that are born to mothers who have been undiagnosed. And as a result, the children are often undiagnosed and put on medications that's not really addressing the possible infection they may be treating. And that is really a whole other kind of a conversation about children and these tick-borne infections that we'll leave for another episode in the future. So best treatment is obviously prevention, Dr. Marion. As we both know, prevention, prevention, prevention. Most of these infections are picked up through ticks and mosquitoes and stinging insects. And, you know, they can cause the Borrelia can be borrowed into the system, into our skin and into our body. But there are other infections too that we call co-infections, like Anaplasma, Rickettsia, Babesia miyamoti, Babesia microti, Borrelia, various forms of Borrelia, Bartonella. I mean, there is a lot of different types of these tick-borne infections that can be borrowed into the system. So what are some of the things that we can do in order to prevent picking up an infection from a tick or a mosquito bite?
Yeah, so again, most Lyme disease is picked up through ticks, mosquitoes, stinging insects. And one of the reasons that we are hammering on all of these points so much is that the burden of this illness is quite great. And we often see patients, you know, the cost to the medical system is estimated about $3,000 per year, but most of these patients will find alternative and naturopathic and other types of treatments. And they're spending about $50,000 a year on average, and sometimes really upwards of that towards more like $100,000 per year. And So we really need to be discussing prevention so that people aren't ever getting to that point. And what I want to say about this is that this is a scary topic. You might be feeling, as a listener, sort of weary about this particular bacterial infection and your potential risk. And we're not trying truly to scare you with this information, but knowledge is power. And as with all chronic illnesses, as Dr. Darvish mentioned, the best approach is to prevent them in the first place. And so this information is scary, and it is a serious issue. But if we can identify things early, it can be treated more successfully. And if we can prevent it in the first place, that's an even better scenario. So our hope is that greater awareness around Lyme disease can lead to increased prevention, as well as increased early identification, which really can save you or your children from long-term health complications. So the National Institute of Health recommends a number of things in terms of preventing tick bites. They recommend to use a chemical repellent with DEET, permethrin, or picaridin. And you probably were taught that DEET is really toxic. It's a really strong neurotoxin. For myself, I spend quite a bit of time in the outdoors, in the backcountry, really long miles away from hospitals and healthcare and so forth. And I just go straight for the DEET, even as a naturopathic doctor. I really understand how toxic and neurotoxic that stuff is, but I'd rather sort of detox myself from that than risk a tick bite. And also not knowing about it is kind of the scary aspect of that. So I'm just going for straight 99% DEET. It's also recommended by the NIH to the National Institute of Health to wear light colored protective clothing, and also to tuck pant legs into socks. And one of the interesting areas of research actually going on right now that I learned about at iLabs is they're developing color changing outerwear and clothing for the field scientists, so that when these scientists are going out and picking and trying to find ticks and do different things in the wilderness, they actually develop some sort of way for the clothing to change color as soon as the person gets a tick bite, which is really just fascinating. But of course, that's only going to be available to research teams for quite a long time, but fascinating work. Of course, avoid tick infested areas. It's something that the National Institute of Health recommends, but really you can't, especially if you are a sort of outdoors person, and I really hope that most people are to some extent anyway. Because there's so much healing that can happen in nature. But as well, there are no areas that are truly tick-free. So you really just can't avoid tick-infested areas. But as well, it's important to check yourself, your children, and your pets daily for ticks and carefully remove any ticks. So this really should be happening on a daily basis, even if your dog is just going to the dog park or spending some time in some tall grass. And it's quite tedious, but it's important that your animals and your children and your family are not picking up this infection. You can make an essential oil tick repellent, and sometimes I'll use this in sort of less risky areas. So basically you're combining essential oils of lavender, peppermint, citronella, lemongrass, cedar, rose geranium, and citrus. Really any combination of those is going to be, to some extent, an insect repellent, and smells a lot nicer than DEET, but definitely not quite as effective. You can add those essential oils to a carrier oil like sweet almond or olive oil, and use about 12 drops of essential oil per ounce of carrier oil. And then you just spray or rub that into your skin. Another way to use DEET without quite getting as many of the toxins in your body is to really just spray all of your clothing, and it will still get into your system, but not quite as much as spraying it directly on your skin. And then we wanted to discuss removing a tick, and I'm going to let Dr. Darvish take this one over, because as we were discussing prior to this recording, I've spent my entire life outdoors. My family went camping every weekend, almost, at least in the warmer months. And no one ever taught me how to remove a tick. I didn't even know this was a thing. And so as, you know, we, we identify these risks later on after they're obviously have been important for many, many years. It's interesting to know that these things should have been taught really quite early on.
You know, oftentimes we think that tick infections are only out there in the woods, or more recently, as the news is coming out with the beaches in California and West Coast. Now, so they're not just on the East Coast. They're really global. Every part of the world has these infection, this Lyme disease that can be transmitted through ticks, through mosquitoes, through spiders. And even here in the Northwest, I've had adults and children working out or playing in their backyard in Woodinville, in Redmond, in Mercer Island, come to me with a bullseye rash, with a tick bite. So it is common on the West Coast. And I think we haven't been taught as routinely as East Coast people have been with regards to checking ourselves and our families and pets, like you mentioned, Dr. Marion, for these ticks. So how do you remove a tick once you do get it? By the way, I do think it's really important for every one of us when we're out there, even for a short hike, camping, wherever we are out in the woods, that we do carry some tweezers and an antiseptic with us at all times, because it's a very easy process. You take your tweezer and you just make sure that you don't squeeze or crush the tick, and you basically pull it straight up and then follow it with some kind of an antiseptic. And my favorite antiseptics are Hydrosol Silver. The company we use is Argentin 23, that's the product name. And then HOCL, and the other product that we use that has HOCL is Briotech. So those are my two favorite antiseptics to really get rid of majority of bacteria and viral infections that may be passed through these ticks. Yes, viruses do pass through these ticks. And at some point we'll talk about that too. There's so much to talk about with this topic. And hopefully we'll get through it.
Yeah, one of the reasons we're telling you how to remove a tick is that the longer it stays on the body, the higher the likelihood the transmission of Borrelia burgdorferi, or any one of these other bacteria or viruses that it's carrying. So there are various statistics out there, but we really find transmission with as little as 3-6 hours or so. But if you can get it right away, the likelihood that those infections are transmitted is much lower. So it is important to remove it. Don't leave it there and try to get to the emergency room. And there's certainly plenty of YouTube videos that you can go watch to see how to remove it safely.
And then the other thing I would add to all of this is to make sure that if you can save the tick and take it to your doctor so that they can send it into the lab to evaluate to see if they find any infections in there. Whether you have any symptoms or not, it is really important, if you've had a tick bite, to go see doctor so that they can evaluate you a little bit more comprehensively. I always put my patients on some kind of a oxidative treatment or a silver therapy orally or intravenously in order to make sure that we get any little bug that may be hanging out in that area. And sometimes, but very rarely, do I prescribe antibiotics. And we'll get to that actually in the next episode, where we discover and explore and discuss treatments and treatment options, both conventional and integrative, holistic therapeutics that we incorporate in our comprehensive treatments for these tick-borne infections. So until next time, thank you again, Dr. Marion, for joining me on these series of tick-borne infections. For anyone who would like to contact Dr. Marion or myself or any of the holistic doctors who specialize in tick-borne infections and chronic diseases, and yes, we have several of them here at Holistic, please visit our website, holistic.com, H-O-L-I-S-T-I-C.com. stique.com. If you would like further educational information on tick-borne diseases or other health conditions, you may also visit my website, drdarvish.com, drdarvish.com. I look forward to another great conversation with you, Dr. Marion, on part 3 of Holistic Health Hour podcast on chronic Lyme disease, tick-borne infections, and until next time.